This is part two of the second set of interviews with István Deák, conducted on April 18th, 2010.
We're here with István Deák. It's April 18th, 2010, and we were just talking about his years in Paris, and he's about to go to Munich. So we're going to pick up with the discussion of Munich, so perhaps you could start with your trip to Munich.
Well, I took the train. I remember that went through Strasbourg. And then the first thing I saw in Germany was a sign saying abort, if you know what that means. Abort. WC. Abort. Yes. And then I arrived in Munich, and it was totally in ruins. So it was another blow and a very sad experience to go back to a city. In fact, to go to a city which was in ruins. Compared to that, Budapest was in much better shape. I mean, the whole avenues, long streets, the central streets of Munich, there were nothing but ruins. 1951. Yeah. Much reconstruction, the streets were clean and the many buildings went up, but I see nothing but ruins, that's wrong. But Leopoldstrasse, Ludwigstrasse, which is the central street where the university is, the impression one had there that this is hopeless. And then all the more dramatic is that within a few years the city was thriving and being reconstructed very quickly. I stayed in a hotel which was built clearly at that time, very shabby, yet was considered the best hotel available. 51. When? I think in July, but I'm not quite sure. It was in the summer of 51. And of course, there were many buildings that were standing. The Regina Hotel, for instance, was there. And the new building of Radio Free Europe, which was built in Englischer Garten, in a public garden, typically for a colonialist power, Americans could build into a public garden, the very ugly 1950-style building. And I went next day to Radio Free Europe and was shown the office where I would be working, not so much as a librarian but an archivist. And the main job was fairly interesting. We were reading Hungarian newspapers that we were getting, or East European newspapers that we were getting through a German agency, and cut out articles that were of some interest and reported to the editors about these articles, sometimes just copying them, sometimes writing extracts or making extracts or summarizing. And that was my job for quite a while. Radio Free Europe is a very mixed experience for me. I'm not proud of it, and I'm not happy with it, and I wish I hadn't gone. So you have to be aware of that. Not that I was badly treated. I was very well treated. But since at the end of it was the expulsion of my parents from Budapest, I feel very guilty about it. And as I said, I wish I hadn't gone. I wish also I thought about it more carefully, of what the purpose of the whole game is. But I was totally overcome by the offer that I was paid the princely sum of $160 a month, plus all the privileges of an American occupier, which is also, you have to understand what it meant to me, that while I was not badly treated in France, but still an underdog with no regular genuine permit to live or genuine permit to work. I never had a permit to work in France, never. I didn't have even a temporary permit. I was always working illegally. Now suddenly you have legal papers, you have the permit to work, and you are one of the privileged and one of the occupiers. And that gave me the feeling, incidentally, that it's not bad for me to in Germany. And I didn't sink to the level of the Nazis, of the Germans, because I'm an American occupier. I had every employee, every foreign employee of Radio Free Europe, whether he came from Switzerland or France or Sweden or England, had the same rank for administrative and other purposes, the same rank as an American officer. So, for instance, we were admitted to, my identity card admitted me to the officers' club, where we were sitting with American officers, and then the American officers were sort of demigods in one's eyes at that time. Not that I had very high opinion of them individually, because I learned quickly that American officers are not always very interesting people. But the status was so extraordinary. As such, as an American person with the privileges of an American officer or an American soldier, you had access to PX, which is the Army Commissary, and you could buy a carton of cigarettes for $1. You could buy a gallon of gasoline for 15 cents, which means that I could buy an old BMW car, pre-World War II BMW car that must have been making 5 miles a gallon if everything went well, and enormous amount of oil it consumed. But I could afford it, because 15 cents even that time was very little money. You had access to hotels, $1 a night in American managed hotels. That is, the best hotels in Garmisch-Partenkirchen, in the Hilton Mountains, for instance, had been sequestered by the American Army for their officers. So I went skiing in the Alps, which meant that I took the train, the first class train, paying less than a third class ticket. I took my girlfriend, who was German, but the conductor didn't dare complain about it, because after all, she was with somebody in the rank of an American officer. He said something, you really shouldn't be here, but we smiled, and that was the end of it. We went to Garmisch-Partenkirchen, went up to the telephoric, went up to the cable car, to the mountain, where Germans were standing in line for hours, and we were always the first ones to be let through. This, the Americans were perfect colonial masters, much in that respect that they were, in many ways, I think, far more, not ruthless is not the right expression, far more assertive than the British and the French, maybe because it was a new experience for them. The British wouldn't have done it so conspicuously. That, for instance, while at Garmisch-Partenkirchen for the train up to Zugspitze, there was an endless line of Germans who wanted to go up there, but they always had to wait because the Americans were always coming and directly went into the train or directly went into the cable car. And then you went up to the mountain, and there was a wonderful hotel, and you paid $1 and you stayed there overnight. So that's how we lived. I was much more aware in the beginning of the privileges and perks of being an employee of Radio Free Europe than what the purpose of the whole game was. Why are we doing it? Is it right to do it? Should we do it? What will happen to our families? They warned us a little bit, our families, but we didn't take it seriously. So that's why I don't think of it as a good experience of mine. I think of it as almost as a shameful experience. I was from until 55, 4 years, 56. Well, we saw a man who didn't say what he represented, but he sort of made us feel that he represented the CIA. He had an office in the building. And he said, you are of course aware that you are endangering your families. He told us. And we said yes. And said, how could I say yes? Why wasn't I more concerned? I don't know. I cannot answer it. But of course, all of us stayed. And there were very interesting people like Gyula Borbandi, if you remember him, the editor of Latohata. The political range was very wide, all the way from former communists, former social democrats, peasant party people, smallholder party people, and conservatives. Not at the beginning. not at the beginning. That's another thing. How come that we tolerated the appearance, the Hungarian Nyilas or right wing, not all of them, but Nyilas, right wing exile of 1944 were at first not hired deliberately and clearly, and we were told that they would not be hired. Then they were hired as typists, some of them, or came from that emigration. It was very clear who belonged to that emigration and who didn't belong. A typist, announcer. And then the first people appeared who were like Béri László, who was editor of a far-right paper during the war and was editing it until even during the siege of Budapest, and then somehow he escaped. Or there was Borsány Julian, who was a colonel in the Hungarian army, and who to me was a very nice and very interesting person and not the least bit of a Nazi. Nothing about him, until I found out what he had done during the war. So that took me 20, 30, 40 years to find out about some of my colleagues. I wasn't looking, I don't know where I would have found it, but for instance, what I found out about Borsányi was that during the war, he was in the Ministry of Defense as an engineer. He was a military engineer, military engineering staff, so it was a very high ranking group. And he negotiated the arrangement with the Germans for Hungarian Jewish labor servicemen to work in Bor in Serbia, in the copper mines, where about 6,000 worked or more. And he, in exchange for copper, which the Hungarian army needed, but without consulting with the Minister of Defense, who was Nagy Vilmos, and who was a very good man, he, behind the back of Nagy Vilmos, he negotiated this agreement. So he wasn't a Nazi, but he was an officer, incidentally of Zipse, German background, who his name was Pehm, and he went back to Pehm in Germany, and then, but then thought better of it and went back to Borsányi. Again, he had changed his name to Borsányi under Gömbös. It was very almost a rule, I think it was an order, that officers had to change their names to Hungarian something, or make it double names so that it were half German, half Hungarian. In any case, Borsányi, as I now much later found out, he's long dead, so it doesn't make any difference to him, that he had done this. This was a great misdeed, and in fact, it was betrayal of his own country to do something behind the back of the authorities and sell 6,000 Hungarian citizens to the Germans for copper that the army might have needed or might not have needed. So there were very foul aspects to the whole thing, but I didn't know this about him, and certainly neither he nor Béri László or any of these people of far-right background gave any impression that they were far-right background. I mean, after the war, this was the same situation, not only in Hungary, but in all other countries, and especially in Germany, the Nazis became the best Democrats. And unless you knew that about their past, you always had the impression, well, worked at Heidelberg for Werner Conze, and he was the most liberal, wonderful professor of history imaginable, and was so taken by him. He was a good friend of his son. And then much later, 1968, it turned out that Conze had been a Nazi, and nobody knew it. So one has a bitter taste in one's mouth, and one feels that one should have known better, but one didn't always know. And I certainly don't want to say that those people of right-wing background, Csonka Emil, was a secretary, private secretary of Szálosi, and he became an editor. But what he said on the radio as an was one of the editors was not more objectionable than what the former communists or the former social democrats. Then what Radio Free Europe said in general, in hindsight, was also at least debatable. And there is no final judgment on Radio Free Europe. Some people in Hungary would say, and some writers about it say, that it had a wonderful service because it provided information that was absolutely not available to the Hungarians, millions of Hungarians. And others say that it misled the Hungarians, especially in the last few years, 55, 56, by giving the impression that if the Hungarians and East Europeans do something about their own liberation, that the Americans would help. What that help would be, nobody ever spelled out. We had no idea. But we also lived in the mistaken notion that something, the Americans will do something. We didn't think of war. In the beginning, we did. In the beginning, we did so much that when I left in 1948, my friends in Hungary asked me to watch for military transports in Austria and Germany. Austria was still under four-power occupation, of course, in 1948. And if you see many American tanks and tractors moving east, or trucks moving east, write us about it in a flowery language, then we will leave immediately. We don't want to be caught on the wrong side of the war. So in 1948, from that, I deduced that we were very much expecting, feeling, expecting a war. I'm sorry, a war. When I went there to Munich, I also was somehow not convinced, but I had the feeling that this is a short excursion to France, to outside France, that this is a very interesting adventure, that it will bring me a little bit of money and I won't be starving anymore, but it's of limited duration. It cannot last long because now liberation is around the corner. How that would be done, I had no idea. I don't think that I ever imagined one way or another as peaceful a war. It's something the Americans must know what they are doing. That was my feeling. By 1955, 1956, I probably was a little bit wiser, but I certainly didn't see through the propaganda of the Americans, of Eisenhower, Dulles administration, which was that one should incite the East Europeans in order to annoy the Russians, but the one didn't have the slightest intention of doing something. And when the revolution came, well, fortunately I was no longer there, I left. So I don't feel guilty of Radio Free Europe's behavior during the revolution, but then in 1956, of course, in Dulles especially, and Eisenhower too, made absolutely clear that they recognized the boundaries of influence between Soviet Union and U.S. states, and that Hungary belongs to the Soviet sphere of influence. In hindsight, I think that the Dulles' move was very wise. It prevented the war, and it allowed a peaceful development, which finally led to the collapse of the Soviet bloc, led to the self-inflicted collapse of the Soviet bloc. But what is really unforgivable is the propaganda, which was that if the East Europeans help themselves, then Americans will help them also. How that help will be was never spelled out, so that after the revolution, of course, the Americans would say, we never said anything like this. And then, you know, there are several books which I don't really read and don't want to have, but looked into it. There are several books on. Should I wait? Well, liberation. What would happen? Yes, there were differences. I mean, the more democratic elements in it, like Borbandi, for instance, who was sort of the spokesman for the leftist emigration, Maroi and others, they imagined a very democratic Hungary, socialist Hungary. Kovács Imre, the peasant leader, who was my colleague. Yes. Well, by 1956, yes, then it seemed imminent. As I said, when I went there in 51, I had the impression that it will last only a short time. But it was very vague. There was no sign of it. There was maybe the hope that it will collapse because it's so terrible that it must collapse. It became realistic as possibility by the time of the 20th Party Congress speech. I mean, if somebody can talk like this and denounce the whole leadership and denounce Stalin, then something fantastic is happening. And then the demonstrations and everything else. So at what point? Anyway, I wasn't there anymore. In 56, I wasn't there. So I cannot say what I thought at that time. But you know, I don't know how much you know about the RFE dilemma. But there are the books about it are really divided, and they're not don't have a consistent line about RFE being guilty or being not guilty. Those who tend to defend RFE point out that the editors who during the revolution went too far were in a minority, and there were very few of them, very few of such statements, which were then pointed out after the revolution. He said this, Gallicus said this, and Gallicus said that, sort of indicating that if the revolution is held out another day, then something miraculous will happen. Or agitating against Imre Nagy. I mean, the big crime of the Radio Free Europe at that time was in late October, early November 1956 was to agitate against, don't trust Imre Nagy, he's just another commie, trust Mindszenty. Now, not everybody at Radio Free would have said such a thing as trust Mindszenty, because most of them disliked Mindszenty. But there were some, and that was the fault of the Americans, especially of Bill Griffiths, who was a political director of Radio Free Europe, that he allowed the hiring of such right-wing people who behaved perfectly normally until then, but sort of lost self-control during 56 and hated Imre Nagy really as a communist. But they were not the only ones, because the one who made the worst statements, which were repeated mostly by communist propagandists and by Western critics afterwards, was Mikas Imre, Gallicus, who was a Jewish democratic writer from the Brașovi Hirlap or whatever it was in Transylvania. And he said, if you look at those quotes from Radio Free Europe, which are circulating so much, again, it's again Gallicus who said, don't trust Imre Nagy and go ahead and don't wait. The other one who was very, really criminally involved, whose behavior can be criticized and almost called criminal, was Borsányi. The military man who was a good friend of mine and whom I liked enormously, not knowing anything about him, and about whom I found out that he had sold Jews to the Germans, and who during the revolution taught them, made speeches about how they should make hand grenades and how they should never stop fighting, and that the government cannot be trusted and they should have to hold out for what he didn't say. I mean, no editor of Radio Free Europe ever said the Americans are just at the border, or the American parachuters are going to. This is what people wanted to hear, and then this news spread. But you cannot pinpoint anyone's statement. I think Bormandy and Gallicus came closest to this point when they were almost saying something, but they never, even they didn't say. The Americans are in the air, or something. The Americans are coming.
So, in terms of imagining a post-Soviet future, this is also the time when people start thinking about European unification. Did you see any signs of that, or was that being discussed?
Hmm.
Or federation schemes?
I wish I would remember, but I think that, yes, obviously it was discussed. Was absolutely in the air. I mean, the coal and steel community came. At that time, I was at the meeting of the coal and steel community. I was sent by Radio Free Europe. And we came back with great enthusiasm. Yes, it was, of course, Yes, that's the future. I'm sure, but this was not. I don't think that it was discussed very much. I must say also, that I'm not the right person to be asked, because whether I should be proud of it, or be ashamed of it, my involvement was very genuine involvement. My heart and soul involvement in Radio Free Europe was very short-lived. After a while, I did other things. First of all, spent an enormous amount of time in sports and girls. I must confess that much more than I should have. Secondly, I began to study. I went to University of Maryland, which had a branch there in Munich, and also at the university. And I was reading books, and did many things, and considered Radio Free Europe more of a job than an involvement, more than not a vocation. And was thinking of getting away from there, but I didn't know how to get away from there. That was my big problem there, because we had an arrangement which really made us prisoners of Radio Free Europe. In order to be able to work in Germany, you had to have a French permit that allowed you to travel abroad and allowed you to return to France. That was the same if you came from Switzerland, from England or France, it was the same thing. And the French permit said, allowed to return temporarily to France to renew his titre de voyage. But he is working in Germany. And the German permit said, allowed to stay in Germany only as long as he works for Radio Free Europe. It was on my visa. So to get out of there was impossible. I couldn't go back to France to live in France. I lost that right. I was allowed to go back for visit, but I wouldn't have had a permit to stay in France. I didn't have a permit to stay in France. In fact, my situation became worse in this respect, that before I left, I already had a three-year permit. After I left, I didn't have a three-year permit. I only had a permit to travel from Germany for visits and for renewal of my passport, of my so-called passport. And in Germany, it was absolutely tied to Free Europe, so I couldn't have, anyway, what would I have done? And the way out of it would have been in the United States, but the United States didn't give you a visa until 1956. The quota was 800. Yeah. Well, in 1955, my parents were called in separately, incidentally, to police headquarters. Yasai Moriter. I don't know what was that. AWO. The Feierhaus. They were, Well, maybe there. There was the police in the case. And they were questioned and asked, where is your son? And they both said, although they knew that this wasn't true, that I was in Paris. I was still in Paris. And they said, you know better. And then I also asked, why didn't I report the money that I sent them? I sent them money quite regularly because the income was very inadequate. And everybody was miserable in Hungary at that time. And I sent money illegally, which is through diplomatic couriers. Everybody did that. I mean, we didn't even know whether the diplomatic courier just said, give $100 and they will be getting a very good exchange. The other possibility would have been ICA. ICA is the official Hungarian way, but you had to send half a kilo of flour and 2 kilos of sugar, and it wasn't as advantageous, but very expensive. And certainly wasn't as advantageous as the way we sent the money. So they would ask, who sent you the money? Why did you get the money? And why didn't you report the money that you received? Now obviously, the courier, and the rumor has it that it was an Israeli courier, was arrested and was found with a list. And so than us. And then they were told that they had only had a week to leave Budapest and go to Kőrös Nagyharsány, which is on the Romanian border, and that they have to live there in an assigned place, and they were excluded from Budapest, and they were under police surveillance. Well, you saw the diplomas of my father. My father was an engineer, and he worked for the Ministry of Heavy Industry. And as your diploma showed, he was working on two projects. One was Lenin Boschmühlwerk, Lenin Ironworks, and the other was Stalin Foundry or whatever it is. And he was he was given a pension. He lost his job, but he was given a pension, and he was given a week to rent a car or rent a truck and put some furniture on it, and then they went there and lived there.
Just my parents. And did they live in Zuglingen at that point?
Yeah, Meschelz. Well, I lived there from the summer of 55 until October 56. My mother was allowed to come back earlier. I don't remember, there were two reasons. I think one that... the main reason was that she was ill. And she was allowed to seek hospital treatment in Budapest. Temporary permit. There was no police station in Kőrös Nagyharsány, but the policeman came once a week to check on them. And it became a very friendly occasion. He came and they had a glass of wine together. Everything was in a very friendly basis. And they, whether it's that policeman who gave the permission or whether they had to go to the neighboring town to seek such a permission, I don't know. But certainly they went, she was in Budapest. And my father was alone in Kőrös Nagyharsány, and then during the revolution he left, and totally on his own he traveled to Budapest by train, by car, walking, all sorts of things. And then he arrived in Budapest, but they had no place to live. So they were first missed cousin, because the apartment was occupied by a prosecutor. And this possibility that the prosecutor had needed the apartment, and that's why they were expelled. But we have absolutely no proof of that. But then in the street, they met somebody who said, I'm leaving for the West. Would you like to have an apartment? And he gave them the key to Nagyajtaj utca. And they had a very nice apartment in Nagyajtaj utca. Pasaryting. Well, they were living very close. Mesa utca was very close. But Nagyajtaj utca, and they have many photographs of their living in Nagyajtaj utca. And then they were living there for many, many years until, God, 1970s, I think, almost 20 years, until they negotiated an arrangement with the prosecutor to give him an apartment so that they can move back into their own apartment. But their own apartment actually was less nice than the Nagyajtaj utca. Because it's their own. I mean, otherwise, it's totally worthless.
So they owned it.
The Mesa utca was an Örökökös. Yes, they owned it. They built it in 1940, and the idea was to being a good investment. It wasn't such a great investment, as it turns out, because it was bauxite beton. Well, it's still there. Yeah. People live there.
But
so
it's
now 60 years old, 70 years old. So it cannot be so bad. But apparently it's impossible to sell it. They tried to sell the apartment before and they couldn't. Nobody was interested because it's bauxite beton. But it's there for 70 years. How long is the house supposed to live? I mean, it's not built like this one, which is now 100 years old. And they were still legally excluded from Budapest. But when the police, this is 1957, so when the police asked in the street once for the ID card, and said, the policeman said, but you are excluded from Budapest, and my parents said, and my father said, yes, but this is no longer valid. And the policeman said, it's no longer valid, and gave it back to them. And when the new ID card was handed out in 57 or 58, he didn't see anything about them being excluded. In fact, they got some paper from some prosecute me, but the same prosecutor, that the expulsion had been illegal. So then, after 56. Well, why not? I mean, the Rákosi regime was repudiated by the Kádár regime. I don't know. I never saw this. I mean, this might be a rumor. Well, maybe they spread this rumor in order to quiet down any possible objection. I never saw that paper. Immediately. I found that immediately, and immediately the big crisis started, because I then went to the directors, and I said, my parents had been deported, must be because of me, and I would like to leave. And they talked me I think Veres Poli wrote the letter. I was corresponding with them regularly. During the whole time, there was never once a week, or even when I would not have received a letter, I would not have written a letter. During the whole Rákosi time, we were corresponding practically every day. Haha, it's my sister's memoirs of 350 pages are based on my correspondence. She has it all. She has everything. That is really very valuable. In fact, you. Oh, well, scan the letters are unscannable, because there are all these 3 milligram or 5 milligram paper, and very often it's written on both sides. It's extremely difficult to read. This airmail letter. And it's sharpening.
There is a program specifically.
Well, I don't know whether it's worth that much of it. Yeah. Well, you have to go to Budapest and get it. I don't have it. It's now Panka who has it in Budapest, Veres Panka. Well, it's certainly interesting. And certainly Panka keeps saying, and Pruzsa, the other, and my sister kept saying, basically, this is just based on your letters and their letters, because I brought back their letters. Yes, so they had both sides. Very interesting stuff, yes. 1948, practically the first day I arrived in Paris. That time I wrote 10-page letters, and then shorter letters, but I constantly wrote to them through Paris. When I was really free Europe, I sent a letter to Paris, and from Paris it was mailed. Well, that's a very interesting thing. We don't know. All I know is that letters always go through. Now, since my parents were expelled from Budapest, and they said, "You say that your son is in Paris. We know much better." So they knew. Now, whether this is because they were reading the letters, or because the AWO officers who were working at Radio Free Europe in Munich, at least two, were working there, I don't remember them at all, no. Now, one of them vaguely, yes, Samoshio, what was his name, yeah. But then he published a book, there is a picture of him in AWO uniform. No, not in Munich, in Budapest, in Munich, yeah. So it's whether he reported on it, I don't know.
So he went back and published.
Yeah. After a while, he said, my mission having been completed, I went back to Budapest. I don't have that book, but the books are Radio Free Europe, like Borbandi's book, are Radio Free Europe, certainly mentions the agents. It's Angol Kedven 13th, vagy valamilyen, as it seems. I have one, I will try to refer. It's a fascinating story. Then there were several people who went back to Budapest, Hungary. Not Spies, but Hungarian refugees who decided to go back to Hungary. Vámos Imre and the poet. Oh God, what was the name of the poet? Famous poet. And he went back to Hungary. Obviously they were asked millions of questions, and so they... Who exactly gave the information, I don't know. But I certainly know that I always corresponded with my parents, and it was never stopped. And We never had any evidence of it there being touched, because we, for instance, we agreed that we put a little something like a grain of salt or something in that. And if it's missing, then it is clear that they opened the envelope. But it was either there or we forgot it. I don't remember. I don't never had a smoking gun. But if you look at the you know what the Stasi did, then the Hungarians must have done the same thing. There were letters, and Stasi was reading letters all the time. Why did they allow it? Why did they allow telephone calls, for instance? You could call, I could call my parents from Paris any time. Very seldom did we call, because it was so unbelievably expensive and so difficult, and you had to wait for hours and everything else. But you could call. They did not prevent you from calling. Yeah. I don't know, the communists didn't think of it. I don't know why.
But you write in one of the, I think you wrote an article in any of the books about you checking your Secret Service files. Like what the
yeah, it's here.
Was
it's here.
Was it regime, right? Or was there anything in this period that we...
No, no.
It was when you went back from the States.
Yeah. It's only after. It begins in 1973. I mean, 64, when I went there. And very short reports. I mean, the big ones are missing. I don't have them. For the time of the expulsion in 1973 and 74, those years which were really interesting, there is nothing in the... And now Karshoy tells me that, of course, it's there, but it's in the Ministry of Information or whatever it's called, and that they don't give it up. But even there, the news are very contradictory. The deputy secretary of interior, Minister Helyettes, aki SDSS, he told me that they looked, there is nothing on me for those years, that it must have been burned and destroyed with so many other things. Karshoy says it's there, but you can't, even Hungarian historians have no access to those files. So maybe it will come upon me. But it begins in 69, when I went back to a conference. And then there's a very brief report that István Deák is here.
No, I don't need to
have
any questions before, but I'm really excited about getting to America.
I wanted to ask one more question about what the atmosphere is like in Germany. Especially from someone who is treated like, the American occupier.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, I had German friends. In fact, I had quite a number of German friends with whom I became good friends, but I don't think that we talked politics very much. It's mostly that these were young men, and we went skiing together, for instance. I remember, and they talked about how they had been in the Hitlerjugend and how they had been enamored with this situation. They were in ski camps and how it was a great experience for them. They were before military age, or they didn't talk about the military service which they might have had at the end of the war. Then I had a girlfriend whom I liked very much, and she one day confessed to me that her brother was killed in the SS. But very little came through this way, little confessions. But we didn't have big, I don't think that we ever had big political discussion with the Germans that I knew, more about the contemporary situation than about the past. But yes, there were these little, there were these confessions. The Ruth was the one who talked to me about the brother, and that the whole family is still unable to recover from that thing, that they don't know how to handle it. Which reminded me a little bit of our mind situation. How do you handle your past? What do you talk about? And I realized that the Germans are in similar situation today, that they have skeletons in the closet, and they don't want to be ashamed of it, but yet they, at the end, they don't want to talk about it either. Then later, when I was in Germany doing research, then I found out much more about the Mesopotamians. When I worked for Conze, and then I was in 68, and that was a very difficult time for me, for everybody at the university because of these constant strikes. And, but that's another story. We are not. I have to be careful not to confuse it with the time when I was in, for instance, Heidelberg with Gloria from 1771, when these were people were very friendly to us, but what drove us, both Gloria and me, crazy and what made us very angry, that we heard again and again, but you are not like the other Americans, or you are not really Americans. But Gloria is really an American. And still, this was a praise. It was meant to be a praise, but it made us very angry, actually. You are not like the Americans. No, they didn't like them too much. At that time, in the 50s, I really can't say, because the ones I knew were friends or lodgers. I was a lodger. But they were all very friendly because they expected something from me. I was, after all, the colonial power. So they expected cigarettes from me, or whiskey from me, or butter from me, and they were all very friendly. In one place, I figured out that the man who was there and who never talked about himself and never posted about his past, that he must have been a Nazi, but he certainly didn't talk to me. He was the boyfriend of the lady in whose apartment I rented the room. It took a while for us to get an apartment. And once we got an apartment, it was a house in which everybody worked for Radio Free Europe. So the situation was a little bit like Paris. You knew a lot of people, but most of them were not natives. We knew Czechs and Poles and Americans. I was very friendly with quite a few Americans, employees of Radio Free Europe, because I knew the language well, unlike some of my colleagues who didn't know any English or very, very bad English. Germans I knew mostly these young people with whom I went skiing. And I must say, I didn't discuss politics with them very much. The maximum I heard was these little confessions, as I said, the brother, or that day, yes, I was in the Hitlerjugend, but you must understand, it was a wonderful sporting experience for me. The emphasis was on sports at that time, and mountain climbing. I did a lot of mountain climbing, and it was certainly a wonderful episode in my life. Yeah, but then I think we have to finish it.
Yeah, but just a bit.
Yeah. Yeah. So what's the next step? No, I went back to Paris for a while, and then by that time I had already been able to apply for an American immigration visa, because there was a new law. The time, the chronology is unclear to me, but there was a new law, the so-called Eisenhower Refugee Relief Act, which allowed 300,000 refugees into the United States, practically all of them from Eastern Europe. And I applied, but I had to go back to Paris to wait for it. And I got the visa there, and I came to America in September 1956. I had a job, which was not a real job, working in a bookstore, so that was one of my professions. But that was IRC, International Rescue Committee, arranged the affidavits. And you had to have an affidavit, you had to have somebody who vouched for you and who said that if I ever become a public charge, that person will take over, and another one who gave me a job. But this was all arranged by IRC. I never met the person who vouchsafed for me. I went to the bookstore once and said, officially I'm employed here, would you like me to work for you? And he said, no, thank you very much, I signed this, but I really don't need your services. And then for a while I worked for Radio Free Europe in New York, totally in secrecy, as a freelancer, writing articles for them. And then I began to study. By that time I already was a graduate student at Columbia, and then I got a fellowship. And then I met Gloria. And she well, at that organization which was sponsored by the Radio Free Europe, but whose job was to send books to East Europeans. It was a big book project, which was a wonderful project, actually. And she was the American with us. There was a Pole, a Romanian, a Hungarian, a Bulgarian, and we selected the books, and we wrote evaluations of those books and gave the names of persons to whom it should be sent. And Gloria wrote it into English, good English, and made these reports. And so that we met in that office. Yeah. And then she became what was called at that time a PhD, pulling husband through. And you never heard that expression? Yeah. I had a fellowship very soon, but it was $2,000 a year, it wasn't enough. And so she worked. Yeah. So this is not a very colorful story. Once I come to America, there is nothing.